before we really start any work in the class, I give out a very simple survey to the students, and it's just a few questions, and it says, what is the internet? Where did it come from? And how do you know that? And we use that as like a launching point for the class. And it's remarkable, like the kinds of answers that you get, because like you're saying, they do shift over time. Like everyone has this notion of what the internet is, but it's very unstable. And in a way, like the definitions are always being argued out. So that's a really interesting place to get into if you're trying to do research, which is like, here's a thing everybody talks about in a casual way, like we all are on the same page. But in fact, when you like scratch at it just a little bit, you find out there's a lot of disagreement, and that disagreement is then tied to power and politics and cultural values and things like that that are really compelling in a bigger picture sort of way.
Educator and researcher Kevin Driscoll joins John and Scoop this time on the Plutopia podcast. We discuss the history of the internet, media's impact upon popular culture, and much more.
Hey, everybody, welcome to yet another episode of the Plutopia podcast. And this one's going to be great. We've got Kevin Driscoll here. He's an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. And he's been researching alternative histories of the internet, politics of amateur telecom, and the moral economy of consumer software. And we'll have to find out about that. So welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. It's so cool to be here.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, my first question for you is, just as a professor of media studies, what sorts of things do you cover in class?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, a class that's very relevant to this topics for today is called Comparative Histories of the Internet. And that's a class I've been working through for a few years. And it's really interesting to kind of explore those topics with students who are immersed on one hand in everyday kind of online interactions, and yet really are not exposed to like deeper roots or even often aware of the kinds of opportunities that have been there, ideas that have been tried, different experiences that are possible. And so it really makes the internet strange to them in a way that can be really refreshing and exciting.
You're in kind of an internet museum right now, because I think Scoop and I are both like museum pieces, relics of the old internet.
Definitely relics.
We were there, yeah.
Cherished artifacts. Come on, give yourself some credit.
Thank you.
Actually, I can find you a unused copy on floppy disk of Windows 95 that I'm willing to part with.
Well, I often am like the port of last call for people's floppies and soggy magazines and things like that. So feel free afterwards. I'm happy to talk.
Have you got a copy of The Matrix by John Quarterman?
Oh yeah, I do. In fact, that's been a really important source for me over the years, going back to it, in part because, I mean, not just it's like this kind of staggering project to imagine undertaking, making an atlas of the online world, but also it came out just like at a turning point where what we mean by internet changed. And so in the context of the book, the internet is like one of many possible networks that you might traverse as you're exploring online. And just a few years later, the internet's like swallowed the whole thing. So everything that is in the book would be called, you know, in a casual way by people, internet services or systems or networks or something like that. So it's just like this amazing snapshot in time.
Yeah, I mean, it's not published anymore, as far as I know. I think it's out of print, but it's an important book. It's definitely one that belongs in your library there.
Well, what got it on your radar? How did you come across that book?
John and I were friends at the time the book came out. He taught me. He was my teacher. He's the one who taught me everything about the internet when I first got plugged into it. And in fact, John and his partner, Smoot Carl Mitchell, gave me my first modem connection that would give me access to the internet. I think that was the first. Okay. There were also, Austin had probably a couple of the first commercial ISPs. Mm-hmm. So, but I was getting into it early on, and John was definitely my guide. And, you know, you and I are both members of The Well, so you know what I'm talking about when I talk about how The Well was a big part of what I was doing back then. And John would always point out to me that The Well is not the internet. And, you know, today he would say, well, Facebook is not the internet. I mean, these applications that sit on top of the internet are not the internet. You know, people sort of assume that whatever app it is or set of apps they use is sort of like, that's what the internet is about, but there's so much more to it. And by digging into the history of it, you're really getting into that. But how'd you get interested in the early internet like that? Were you there for it?
I mean, I had some early experiences. I grew up in Massachusetts, so kind of like around Austin, there was ISPs and things like that, maybe a little bit earlier than in other places. And then, you know, many things happened. And when I ended up going to grad school and starting looking for topics, I was pretty interested in new media and political communication and things that social movements being organized online. And I assumed that there already would be these histories written and like some of these stories documented about dial-up bulletin boards and grassroots networks and things like that. And there hadn't been that much work at the time on it. And so then that started me down this path of writing more historical research and doing interviews with folks and tracking down floppy disks and old books and things like that to try to fill in the gaps. And so it's funny you mentioned this question about teaching, because the thing I do in that class on the very first day is before we really start any work in the class, I give out a very simple survey to the students, and it's just a few questions. And it says, what is the internet? Where did it come from? And how do you know that? And we use that as like a launching point for the class. And it's remarkable, like the kinds of answers that you get, because like you're saying, they do shift over time. Like everyone has this notion of what the internet is, but it's very unstable. And in a way, like the definitions are always being argued out. So that's really interesting place to get into if you're trying to do research, which is like, here's a thing everybody talks about in a casual way, like we all are on the same page. But in fact, when you like scratch at it just a little bit, you find out there's a lot of disagreement, and that disagreement is then tied to power and politics and cultural values and things like that that are really compelling in a bigger picture sort of way.
What's the wildest response you've ever got on that question of where did the internet come from?
That's a good one. So, I mean, it reveals something, which is the most common answer will be some variation of a story that's like, once there was the ARPANET, or like the US military made some networks and then stuff happened. And then there was like web browsers and Facebook. There's this like huge jump. So a lot of my work has been about like filling in the gaps and making that accessible to people who didn't have a firsthand experience of it. But you do get some wacky answers. And the most common to me wacky answer is to just say like, Bill Gates invented it, or Steve Jobs. Like sometimes the answer is just that simple. And it's, you know, they're being kind of tongue in cheek about it. It's their first day of class. They're not taking it that seriously. It's anonymous. So, you know, I just let them write whatever they want. But it also kind of reveals a way that the community basis of the networks gets lost in all of the commercialization of it. That obviously commercialization is really critical to like spreading access to these online systems. But even when you're looking at the military research kinds of networks, those are communities within the bigger military institutions. And that purpose of like bringing people together to communicate over distance is such a fundamental piece of it. It precedes anything to do with Apple or Microsoft or Amazon or these kind of big companies that get built around it.
In the early 80s, I got involved with computers, and I had services like CompuServe and Genie, which was the General Electric Network, and later AOL. And I kept hearing about this internet thing, but I could never find the doorway until I got involved with some people in the music business who directed me to some local ISPs. And boy, was that an experience going from the closed communities like, CompuServe and AOL into that wild open kingdom of the internet. But I got in trouble talking to people when I pointed out that a lot of the early internet applications were only popularized when people found out you could get porn on them. So have you covered the influence of porn on the internet?
Well, so another class I'm responsible for in our department is that I team teach with other folks is history of media. That's just like a required class. If you become a media studies major at University of Virginia, your next class is history of media. And I think semester after semester, I'm thinking about this, like, we have to talk more about porn because it's not just an internet story. It's like home video, photography. I mean, access to sexual images is such like a powerful force drawing people to experiment with new media and go outside of their comfort zone. And it's easy to like be flippant about that because obviously like on some level it's funny and on another level it can be quite exploitative. But I mean, human sexuality is a pretty fundamental part of what it means to be a person. And so this kind of like upsetting of social norms around access to porn is a really big part of it. And in this new book that I have coming out this spring, which is specifically about bulletin boards, I do talk about porn. And it's like, up until that point, there's, you know, plenty of access to porn, even in the smallest towns in the US. You can go to 7-Eleven or something and there's some access to porn there, but you still have to have an interaction with somebody to get it. Like even just that moment of going to the cash register. And that's a big hurdle for folks. So the idea that you could get a computer and get a modem and even display an image on the screen, a photographic image on the screen of the computer, is obviously like pretty compelling to folks for lots of reasons. But I've also done some research on the French Minitel, which is this other pathway into the online world. And there, human sexuality again is like a huge force, but it's not for porn because there is not really a way to display porn meaningfully on the terminals of the Minitel. It's to have anonymous, like flirtatious chats with other people that may or may not result in meeting up online, offline. Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't, but there's this notion, there's this category of services called the Pink Minitel, which is in some ways like the best known feature of that system, where these like adult oriented chat lines, and no surprise, they're like a big part of the system. But I guess what's kind of funny about it is like we project backwards this idea of what porn is like on the internet now or has been for the last 20 years. But in these kind of early systems, as you all know well, even getting like a JPEG to show up on the screen of your computer required some wherewithal. And it was not like a default component of running a computer in the 1980s to see like photographic images, nevertheless, never mind like a video clips or something. So I kind of think there's this interesting part of it where you have to get some technical expertise to even get the porn. And so there's, you know, we should think about this like motivation story there. But yeah, it's also the story that like the boosters of these networks never really want to promote. So for example, like French Minitel system is state sponsored, and the state was happy that lots of people were experimenting with this big system that they had invested a lot in. It was important to have people going online and doing stuff on Minitel, but they didn't also want to really celebrate that the reason they were going online was to have like cyber sex with strangers in chat rooms. So there's always this like careful negotiation. You kind of see the same thing around the early days of the web when it starts to become like a mass phenomenon and folks realize how easy it is to access porn. It's like you want to celebrate these positive sides without also kind of selling it as this system like completely drenched in pornography. I don't know how that mirrors with your all firsthand experience.
Pretty much. And you know what Minitel reminds me of is the early news groups that you would find. And initially they were just text, and then they started developing, you know, binaries. And that's mm-hmm. where people got their some of their early porn to fix. But what was the big selling point for all of this was it's anonymous, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what motivates a lot of people on the internet, not just porn, but weird posting, attacks, trolling. People think because they're invisible that they can get away with a lot more than they could in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, thinking about the classroom environment, one thing that's changed in the time that I've been teaching in higher ed is that early on there was an assumption that it was like online anonymity is on the whole a good thing with some costs attached to it. And I feel like the mood in my classes has shifted to where now the assumption at the start is anonymity is a bad thing with some potential for good. That the opinion has shifted for my students. They're much more concerned about trolling and fake accounts and people being deceptive online. And we have to work more to think about, well, what are the potential for like empowerment or self-exploration or identity formation through being in these like online spaces? When can anonymity be like a positive thing for someone? And it's interesting to see that reversal happen. I kind of think you see it reflected in like the dominant social media platforms like Facebook really enforcing real name usage.
Well, the going all the way back to the well, I mean, the well always insisted that your identity be known to them. There were a few people, like they might have had some celebrities on there where they sort of let them adopt another identity on the system, but they knew who they were. And there was a common understanding early on that anonymity could have some real downsides. And we've seen that be the case over and over again in communities, that when you're totally anonymous, you're also totally not accountable. You know, you don't really have to be accountable for your behavior or your actions. So generally speaking, our thought was always that anonymity was not, that there were too many downsides to anonymity, at least in online community spaces.
Yeah, you know, something I wonder about a lot, and the well is just the perfect kind of way into thinking about it, is for a long period of time, and like well into my lifetime, going online and entering into a community space, a forum or something, whether I used my real name or not was almost immaterial to like the larger narrative of my life, because that place felt private. It felt like I was going to like a club or a cafe, or like I was in a place. If you were there with me, you could see what I was saying and hear what I was talking about. But I didn't have the feeling until probably 10 or 15 years ago that it was like everything I say online is potentially going to be crawled by Google and indexed and then associated with my name in search results for years and years. And that really seemed to change what was the stakes of anonymity, that it wasn't just about like the health of the immediate community, but it could have all these like unpredictable knock-on effects elsewhere.
About how you present yourself, right?
Yeah. But even just like, you know, I think of like nightclubs and cafes and stuff like that, because it's like, if I meet you in the environment of like, we're out at night and we're at a particular place and we're dressed a certain way and people are doing something, I understand like the terms of our interaction totally differently than if it's the middle of the day on a Wednesday and I'm at your place of work. And I can be friends with somebody and know them on those two levels and like be really clear about where we are. And the kind of like loss of time and place and the search engines indexing everything collapses all of that across these different spaces online, so that you sort of lose that a little bit.
Well, we should also talk about the upsides of anonymity, particularly in some countries where if you can be identified, you might be tortured or killed. Mm-hmm. And that was always a thing. And then there's the idea that you might be a woman with an abusive husband. I mean, there's a lot of situations where it's good to be able to hide yourself. But another positive was that online people could assume an identity that I wouldn't exactly say was not their own identity, but it was an identity that they, I mean, we all kind of have different identities kind of contained in here, right?
Yeah.
So you could sort of manifest another identity that you mostly suppress, and you could like be another person, or you could be another way. And to do that, you might want to adopt a different persona, you know, even with a different name. Good example is the late Chris Locke, who died recently. He had one identity he used called Rage Boy. He had another one called Cat Herding, which was a female identity that he had. And it's K-A-T, cat herding. And these were like different manifestations of Chris. You know, he was one person. These were other people who he sort of, you know, he contained multitudes. And there's that aspect to it. And if you're in a community space, you might want to play with that a little bit. You might want to be able to come in as a different person, especially if you're in a space like Second Life, for instance, where people like to be able that you can adopt an avatar, and you might want to adopt an avatar that's not necessarily 100% representative of who you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Identity comes into it a lot.
Yeah. I mean, something I've been really reflecting on a lot in, like, you know, the Wells can ongoing life is a reflection of this too, is that if people feel some like ownership over the space and they value the interactions they're having there, then the space can afford a lot of flexibility in terms of like changing our identity or having multiple accounts and things like that. Cause it's on the basis of like some assumption that people don't want to like ruin the party. They don't want to poison it. And so, or there's going to be some consequences or like accountability for really crossing some sort of line. Or there's people around who are responsible to be hosts or to be moderators or something like that. And a lot of the things that I think have gone sideways on the big platforms is that you don't have that. You don't have this feeling of like accountability or, you know, we're in this together. I'm arguing with you today. I'm going to be not arguing with you next week. It almost feels like drive-by arguments that you have on the big platforms with mostly strangers who you have no accountability to at all.
I always refer to those places as places where people do drive-by posting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a communication crime. But yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking, now that this book is coming out about bulletin boards, folks are asking me a lot about, you know, what are things from the context of bulletin boards that you think provide some lesson? And the thing that I just don't see as clearly in a lot of these other spaces are people like the bulletin board's sysop or the host of a forum or the moderator who's like really invested in keeping things going and maintaining some norm. And that doesn't mean that every space has to have the same tone or the same norms or the same expectations of civility, but everybody there is kind of on board and there's some plan or some like this meta level discussion of what's acceptable to do in that space. And I mean, when you traverse earlier systems, be they like Usenet news groups, where people would direct you to the FAQ and be like, we've already gone over that. We're not going into that, that particular flame war again, or, you know, certain message boards where you have to be approved by a moderator or read some like preamble before you can start posting. Those kinds of little like barriers or little gates they're not keeping everybody out. It's not about exclusivity, but it's about like setting the norms before the people start to engage.
Yeah, making it clear. Rules of the road is what Harold Reingold calls it.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that, or maybe we should expect to see something of a return of that. Yeah,
there
kind of
are,
like care.
You know? There are, you know, some closed groups on Facebook that operate that way, but they're the exception rather than the rule. A lot of the groups you get into are just, you know, it's the Wild West and everyone is out for whatever their own purposes are. But, you know, I wanted to shift directions.
Yeah.
Are you covering in your classes the evolution of streaming media, which, you know, back to the porn thing, that's where streaming media got its big boost. But now we have, you know, basically streaming media replacing what originally was the turf of cable. And we're seeing music, instead of being on radio, it's streaming on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a feeling of where this came from, where it's going, that you pass along to the students?
Yeah, well, streaming has really thrown television, film, and radio studies, which are like subfields of media studies, for a loop, because there was a way that those fields had been constituted, that there was like some kind of basic foundational agreement on what is a film and how is it different from a television show, and how, you know, these kinds of ideas, or that radio broadcasting follows certain routines. And I think streaming offered people a chance to step back and start to reevaluate some of the things that's going on. So you see new research that's called like post-network TV or streaming. The podcasting also has certainly like changed a little bit. We could think about it as like radio on demand, and you don't often see it framed that way, but certainly there's like a parallel with television, with on-demand television and on-demand radio. But I think it's more about, for my personal interest in it, it's more about how it changes the rhythms of life. And by that, I mean, we have a shrinking set of media events that are simultaneous. And so like it tends to be political events or natural disasters or big sports events where you kind of like everybody's on the same timeline. And the Super Bowl is happening now, we're all watching it. And if you care about the Super Bowl and you try to watch it later, you have to go way out of your way to avoid finding out what happened. And you're going to miss out on that feeling of like something exciting happens and you're with other people, whether you're in the same room or you're like chatting with them or texting them or calling them or something like that. So that used to happen with all kinds of stuff, dramas and network TV and nightly news and things like that. So we are kind of breaking up the structure of time and the flow of television programming. At the same time, I kind of think there's this new appreciation for certain media forms that were tied to older media. So podcasting is absolutely like a site of innovation that is based on people recovering things like the radio drama, which is not the same as an audiobook. It is like a unique medium with its own affordances, or greater access to the, you know, metaphorical airwaves for talk on topics that were otherwise excluded for various reasons. And so we got to a point for a while where talk radio in the United States was really closely aligned with conservative talk radio, or almost one and the same, because conservative talk radio had become so profitable. It was like dominating many markets. And with people being more and more comfortable listening to radio style media in other forms mediated through the internet, then we have this like opportunity for redefining what that can be. Yeah. And I don't know if you're seeing similar changes on your end also.
You have a great deal of fragmentation there too. Mm-hmm. Everybody can be sort of in their own world with their own media. There's so many podcasts and there's so many like streaming video channels, YouTube channels, regular like traditional programming channels. So each person in 1950s, 60s, when there were just three networks, was probably watching kind of the same stuff and getting their heads being hit with the same messaging. And now you got everybody hit with really diverse sets of messages. And when you meet somebody, you really don't have that same sense of, you know, I know where you're coming from, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of confusion, I think, because of that. And I think Scoop was about to say something there.
I was just pointing out that conservative talk radio basically took over a medium that was dying. You know, AM mm-hmm. radio, you know, when FM radio became the means of broadcasting music in stereo and really high quality, AM became kind of the bad neighborhood where people went if they couldn't afford getting onto expensive media. And once that was obvious to the conservative policy makers, they started really organizing, you know, getting these talk show hosts out there and organizing networks to where basically AM radio is owned by just a very small number of companies. So it's it's now, you know, little networks of conservative thought.
I wonder what you think about here's like the big change in addition to the fragmentation is that feeling of like radio is in a place And so if you think about going on a road trip and you drive like out of the broadcast range of a station that you like, and then you start rolling through the dial and looking for the next one, and you drive for a few hours, then you do the same thing. And if you're on Sirius XM or you're listening to podcasts, you could drive across the whole country and you listen to the same thing the whole way.
Well, you're in more control of your programming, which also right. means that, and it gets back to what I was saying, you're hearing just what you want to hear. And politically, it probably means you're not being challenged at all in your beliefs, your political beliefs.
Mm. So you think about it as like a echo chamber kind of effect.
And you can see that kind of on a place like The Well, for instance. Most of the people on The Well are kind of old lefties, right?
Uh-huh.
Were you surprised to find The Well there when you joined?
Was I surprised by its personality?
Well, just that it was still so alive. You know, people will say to me, oh, yeah, I remember The Well. Whatever happened to The Well? You know, and it's like, well, The Well is still there.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good question about surprise. You know,
I mean, it's like it was a BBS. The Well started as a BBS and it just kind of slid onto the internet. And originally it was mostly people in the Bay Area, and now it's people from all over the place. And the point we shouldn't lose the point I was going to make, which is you've got all these old lefties on there. You have a few people who show up who are a little bit more to the right. And, you can really feel the water shaking, man, when all those people are in the same room, right? So we have a few conferences there. And to your point, The Well is a place where everything is hosted or managed. Yeah, you've got usually a couple of hosts for each what we call conferences or, you know, forums, major forums. And they used to call that, instead of calling it a host, they used to call it a fair witness. Which gives you an idea of what that person's supposed to do, you know, and what it really is you could also say referee. Mm-hmm. And as a host, you kind of don't jump in with your host hat on too often. And often when you do, it's to break up a fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I guess that's where the geography part and the like stability or community health come together for me. A lot of bulletin boards are local, even if they have like greater, I would say, translocal participation. So The Well is still, to me, a Bay Area phenomenon. Even though I'm interacting with people from all over, in my mind, I can almost feel it like I'm connecting to that place because I so strongly associate it as like a place in the geographic center. And I have a friend who's old school on The Well, who was using it in the early 90s from Paris, and he was tunneling over some IP network something to get there. So for him, he definitely felt like, I'm leaving home and I'm going to have a conversation with these people over here. And then eventually he moved to Northern California. So you can sort of see this like way that the space goes together. And something in internet history that I think is important and that I talk to students about a lot is like there was different periods, particularly outside the web, where you really knew when you were going to another network. It was like you had to type something in and you waited a moment for that you might have to log in at multiple stages going from one network to the next one. And you could feel this, like you could imagine yourself moving through some kind of like, you know, virtual space and then arriving at your destination, whatever it is. And the web kind of collapsed all that with this, you know, the URL is this like beautiful thing that brings everything into communication with everything else, but it also erases that feeling of like traversing all these different networks. So with many bulletin boards, they're a fraction of the number of people as The Well. They're more like one area of The Well, one theme, maybe 10 to 100 people interacting. Almost all of them live in the same town or like little cluster of towns. They're in the same area code. So you can have a huge flame war with somebody online, but then you might be standing next to them at the grocery store the next day. Or if the moderator has to step in, they might just call you on the phone or like show up at your door and be like, can you kind of stop doing what you're doing online? And that idea that like the online space is really porous and like can spill over kind of often is a compliment to the things we were saying about anonymity. because it's not just about like your name and your online identity. It's that this is like an extension of these relationships that you have with people that are not just about like by being on the computer. The computer lets you talk to people that you might not see as often, and it creates this like persistent kind of dialogue or place to meet. But at the end of the day, it's like the online offline distinction is not quite so strict as maybe it would seem. And so that's why I kind of come back to that question of like space a lot, even when we're talking about radio, because like if we're listening to the same radio station, you know, you might have had that experience before of like you're listening to radio in the car and you get out and you go into a store or something and they've got the same station playing in the store and you feel this like continuity, like we're all, these are our local airwaves.
You talk about your friend in Paris accessing the well. It's similar to my early experience with BBSs, is some BBSs would have a list that you could download of other BBSs and how to get through to them. And they were all over the place, you know, all over the country, some all over the world. But you know, most of us couldn't afford the international telephone rates. We could barely afford, you know, long distance rates. If you tried to dial into a BBS in New York State from the Bay Area where I was living, that was, you had to really want to go there because it was not cheap. You know, people think of, you know, long distance calls now, it's just something you do with your smartphone and it doesn't cost you anything. Well, it does, but only in the background there. But in those days, when there was only one phone company, you paid a severe price if you really wanted that information on that BBS. You know, you had to choke yourself down all that money that you're going to have to spend to connect. And that was one of the charms of the early BBSs, though, because they were everywhere. And if you could get a list and just dialing into them was kind of a thrill. You know, I was easily thrilled in those days.
Well, and this actually takes us to the idea of like World War IVnet and FidoNet and the various networks of BBSs that found ways to exchange like email and so forth. And Quarterman, when he wrote The Matrix, he was sort of figuring out the universe of systems he wanted to look at was the internet and the systems that connected through the internet, but were not actually part of the internet. Like they would, it was like the UCP thing. You could have a BBS where you would dial up and download mail and upload mail, but you didn't stay persistently connected to the internet, but you might be networked with other systems built with the same software.
Yeah, there was a really lively community actually around Dallas-Fort Worth who really like took, so, you know, Tom Jennings and John Medill, the early folks building FidoNet, really established like the fundamental like idea that made this possible of kind of how do we reduce the overall system-wide cost of all these long-distance calls and still be able to shuttle messages all over the country and then eventually the world? But then there was all these like really fascinating little tweaks on that made it possible to do all these other things. And so I think about like the kind of second generation FidoNet activity with programs like Opus and Front Door and Binkley Term that let you do some of that like package up the messages, make a zip file, and then you're going to download this super compressed file just to how short can we make these phone calls so that folks are only going to pay the barest minimum at 1 a.m. to get that long distance call through. And in my research, I was really curious about like the long life of FidoNet, because FidoNet still goes, it still runs. And in many ways, like the hobbyist FidoNet of the North America declined earlier than it did in other parts of the world because of our earlier access to commercial ISPs, but also different regulations about modems and different pricing. Yeah. Oh, I cite this in the book, actually.
I hope so. Yeah
we no did doubt. This. This is in there.
This is when I was at a Computers Freedom and Privacy conference, I think it was, and I interviewed Tom, really long interview with him. That's probably somewhat cut. And then another one with Phil Zimmerman about PGP.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And those are both online.
One of Tom's computers.
Wow, that's great. Tom is a Plutopian. He's a Plutopia friend. We've interviewed him here on this podcast a few times too.
He's an incredibly generous, like,
he's an amazing person.
Really special person. And actually someone I met very early in this turn towards doing more historical research, and his being so forthcoming and like, and really just generous with his time and experience was like gas on the fire for me of like driving a lot of the other work that would come after. So yeah, I've always want to give him a shout out for all of his contributions. Well, so thinking about this like Fido thing, and something that actually Tom mentions too, is like once the idea got out there, it really had its own lives and afterlives. And in parts of like Eastern and Northern Europe, there was lots of connections around the time of the fall of the Iron Curtain. And the ways that the telephone networks are organized there was so different than here that some of the things we take for granted, like, just didn't apply. So here we paid sort of like a flat rate for your local telephone service, and then you can call local numbers all you want. That wasn't true everywhere else in all other telephone networks. So there was places where you had to pay not a lot, but you had to pay for every phone call. So then the pressure is on to reduce the time you're online at all, like for anyone. There's some really interesting like cultural stuff where people who were in former Soviet countries building FidoNet could see FidoNet and bulletin board system as like an independent new communication infrastructure that was like part of how they were imagining a new future for their communities. Because as you know, like a lot of this, the state's infrastructure was not especially reliable going forward. So a lot of the what would become Russian internet was super, very, very local, like town level, people building town level communications, and then inter-town communication, sending emails and files would be billed and handled differently than intra-town communications, which is just like a completely different way of organizing space than we would see here in the US.
Yeah, I mean, the early internet was, I guess, more conducive to a different kind of association and relationship that could evolve. And now things are kind of fragmented. A lot of it has to do with social media and the way social media evolved or has evolved. But I think that we should mention your book, The Modem World, a lot of what we're talking about, I think you cover in there. And your book blurb says, how can these untold stories from the internet's past inspire more inclusive visions of its future? And I just wonder, do you have an answer to that question? Have you kind of figured that out, or is it in the book?
I figured it out, and I'm waiting. No.
You say, well, you got to read the book.
It's not a murder mystery. I'm happy to give away the ending. But yeah, I think about it like everybody, you know, there's an idea in sociology about the social imaginary, which is like you step out the door and you have this idea in your mind, like the background noise of life is what's possible in any given moment. And that sense of like possibility doesn't cover what's actually possible. It is socially constructed and negotiated in your conversations with other people. What's reasonable? What's like, what's likely? What's probable? What would be good? What would be bad? And the stories we tell about the past, and especially stories that we repeat time and time again, those have some effect on like shaping our sense of what's possible for the future. And so when you think about my students who come into my class and they tell a story about ARPANET or Apple computer or something like that, dot-com bubble stories, that's actually kind of a limited way of thinking about this thing, this like amazing resource we have that is the internet. And I wonder to them, like as a provocation, which is if we change that, so that the common way, the common wisdom about the internet is that it was built in no small part by the contributions of amateurs, activists, educators, underground social movements, local communities, churches. We would have a really different way of thinking about the current state of things. To look at what you're talking about, the atomization and platformization, we would see that as aberrant. Like this is a shift from the way things were being done for a long time. And maybe we're not happy with it, rather than people feeling like, well, this is the internet we've got. Yeah, you can have these like big visions of how things would be different. And it's like, no, there was a real period of time that involved millions of people all across the globe where things were organized very differently than they are now. So recovering those stories is about shifting people's expectations to where they may demand different of the systems they rely on now.
When you look at the way the internet has progressed over the years, it always seemed to rely upon a technological innovation. My first modem was a 300 baud modem, and I thought that was pretty cool, but there were certain things I couldn't do. When I got a 1200 baud modem, it's like I'd traded my Volkswagen for a Lamborghini, or so I thought. And it progressed like that. And, you know, the same thing went with the hardware. Your computers, you know, were little, you know, you might have 16K of RAM. It's like, whoa. And it kept growing. But, the internet growth really depended upon the technological innovation that allowed you to do these things. And do you cover that kind of a timeline in any of your courses?
Yeah, I think the way a lot of my classes work, especially ones that are more about technology, like the ones we're talking about, it's like there's multiple kind of lenses that you could use to look over time at change. And so one way to do it is you look at like technological change. And then other ways you might look at like social change, people's everyday practices. And so I'm always trying to get students to see them like woven together. How did changes in the social realm affect how people made sense of the technological realm? How did changes in the technological realm there kind of fold over into the social realm? Because for new technical innovations to land, for them to like seem innovative or compelling, there has to be some expectations set up on the social side. So I think what the modem is like this technology I'm totally obsessed with, in part because particularly in the 80s, if you had never seen someone go online or you'd never experienced being on a bulletin board or chatting with people on CompuServe, it's really hard to understand why it's worth the money because it was so expensive. So there's this survey conducted alongside the census in the late 80s. They started to ask people about their computer usage and they published a supplement to the census at the end of the 80s. And they're saying like, just trying to get rough numbers because they really, people didn't have a good clear sense of like how many households have PCs, stuff like that. And they asked them like about peripherals. And so you can get a rank, like a priority list there. And so people's peripherals are like printer, second disk drive, joystick, almost anything. And modem is at the bottom. But then when you're looking at it through a historical lens, it's like, that's true. A fraction of people had access to a PC and then a fraction of a fraction had a modem attached to the PC. But for those people who did have a modem, it was often their most important thing. So there's this interesting thing, like once you're in, you know how exciting it is. And you know, to go from 300 baud to 2400 baud is like quantum leap. I mean, there's almost no upgrade that you could do to your smartphone now that would compare to that like complete transformation in what's possible. Even getting back to what we were talking about before, downloading a single image at 300 baud, like a high-res VGA picture, would take a long time. And so to multiply your throughput by 8, that really transforms what you're willing to do. So yeah, I am interested in that, but always in conversation with the social side. And so if everybody you know has a 2400 baud modem, well, and you're running a BBS, you're going to add features to that BBS that would take advantage of this new bandwidth that you had. A lot of the like FidoNet kind of message bundling techniques started to really take off when these higher speed 2400 and up modems came around. And there's some really cool evidence that the modem makers knew about that and were specifically reaching out to sysops to get them to adopt their modems. So the you may know like the Courier modem is a really well-known, widely adopted modem. They had a deep discount for sysops as long as the sysops would put on the welcome screen of their BBS that you were connected to a Courier. So they're doing a little bit of like viral marketing, but then they gave the people a super deep discount. So there's a period of time where like a huge portion of FidoNet is all running over the same modems, these same like high-speed carrier modems. And that is reducing the overall cost for communications for, I don't know, a million people. I mean, 10,000 or more nodes all sending files and mail over this, all moving from 2400 baud to 9600 baud is like such a huge transformation in what's possible.
Well, you're making me think about when Megadeth, which is a, you know, the band Megadeth, they built, the first I can recall hearing about it was a band website that had a lot of pictures on it. And I really wanted to see that. So I was, you know, I had an early browser. I think I was using Mosaic browser and trying to look at this Megadeth website. And, you know, you'd like kick it off and an hour later you'd come in and maybe a third of the page had loaded or whatever. But it was really transformative when we started getting faster modems. And at the same time, we found more and more ways to digitize photography and finally had digital cameras. I mean, people don't really realize it. You see that cartoon on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. That's because you couldn't see anybody that you were talking to online. You'd be on the well for years and have no idea what the people looked like that you were talking to. And then around 2000, it started to change. And I can remember exactly where I saw this change. There was an online networking site you don't hear much about it anymore. It was called Ryze, R-Y-Z-E.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I remember joining Ryze, and that was the first system I was ever in where people were routinely posting pictures of themselves, and you could actually see what the people looked like that you were talking to.
Wow.
And that's a big transformation. And then another thing is, like, in the early 2000s, you know, people didn't have cell phones. And I did a project here called Wireless Future, where we were envisioning the future where there would be this pervasive wireless. And it was really hard to get your heads around what that was going to mean. But it, I mean, people today really can't, they probably can't even get their heads around or imagine how primitive our situation was back then. And I don't think back then we would have quite completely been able to get our heads around what we would have now.
And
in all of this sophisticated technology, the technology people use the most and like the most, I think, is texting.
Yep. I think we reinvent the chat room every few years. There's an anecdote in Janet Abate is a historian of technology who wrote this book, Inventing the Internet, which is like the real canonical history of the ARPA packet switching story. And there's a story in there, which is basically like, you've just read 150 pages about how we overcame these amazingly difficult technological challenges and organizational problems. And all it was to provide access to supercomputers across the world and things like that. What did everybody do? Email. Like, that was the reason everybody wanted to get a node. They wanted to get connected. And that's a funny thing to like laugh about, but at the same time, we should see it as like a reflection of our priorities as human beings, is to be connected to one another and be able to send messages and texting.
Simple communication. Is like
transformative. Yeah. And standardized texting too, I think, is really the key. And for some period of time, SMS was just like, didn't matter where you were in the world, people could send SMS to each other. And now we've refragmented mobile messaging into WhatsApp and Telegram and all of these other things. But I do think there's something interesting there about like, we want to be able to send messages to other people. And it would be cool if we could also send pictures too.
Well, yeah. And we're able to coordinate in a big way. Mm-hmm. There was a story in Howard Rheingold's books, Smart Mobs, which is sort of about this piece of the evolution. And he opens the book by talking about being in a little town in Japan, and there's like a fountain, I think, in the town or something. And suddenly all these kids start converging on the fountain, and his realization that they had all coordinated a meeting using text. You know, and this is before text was commonly used in the U.S. This was like seeing it happen in Japan and saying, this is, you know, this is going to be a huge deal. And a lot of people weren't seeing it then, but Howard saw it.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this thing. I just have to mention about the photos, because I also think that's like one of those hooks where you can ask people, when did the first picture of you get online? You know, for people born today, it's my parents took a picture of me the 5 seconds after I was born and posted it to all their family. But there was definitely like bulletin board systems where the hosts would offer a service to the users of like, if you mail me a picture, I'll scan it for you, and then you can have a picture of yourself. And lots of people had like the one photo of themselves that they would use in every situation to make themselves knowable or seen. But even before that, I got some copies of the Genie magazine, which is like, if you subscribe to Genie, you got the little monthly magazine. And they did a thing where they would put little profiles of popular users or some users in the back pages of the magazine. And it was like, here's the folks you've been talking to on the roundtables this month. Here's, you know, Scoop, here's Kevin. This is a picture of him. Here's a couple little pieces of information about him. And you can imagine like referring to that after having talked to that person online for 3 months. And it's like, oh, well, here he is. Here's a picture of him.
Yeah.
I think that's such a fascinating component.
Yeah, Genie was an interesting online community, and yeah, I was on it early on, and I had a great experience that showed what kind of community it had. When we had the earthquake in San Francisco in 1989, all the phones were, I mean, long-distance service was dead. Most people's phones were dead. Mine was alive, and I was able to get a dial tone. I was able to get online. So I got on Genie, and there were other people in the Bay Area and around the country formed an ad hoc, you know, emergency communications service, where if people wanted to let people know that they're in the Bay Area and they're okay or they're not okay, mm-hmm. people would go on and say, okay, give me your mom's number. I did that. A guy in Dallas said, well, do you need to let someone know that you're okay? I said, yes, my mom lives in Big Spring, Texas. And I gave him the number, and she got this call from this guy. She didn't even know about the earthquake. and I did the same thing. I took people's numbers who wanted to find out if their aunt in Mill Valley was okay. And I called, and they were okay. And that was amazing, and that was my first really interesting, you know, thing where people stepped up, you know, outside of their usual online activities and did something good.
And just a few years after that, people from all over the world were coordinating a response to the Southeast Asian tsunami, and then mm-hmm. later to Katrina. You know, I could mm-hmm. talk about those things for a while, but we're about to run out of time. Kevin, is there something else that you would like to say about your book before we drop off?
Sure. So the book will be out in April, and it's called The Modem World. It'll be published by Yale University Press. You can pre-order it now if you want to make sure a copy makes its way over to you. And then over the next year or so, I'm building a companion website at modem.world. on the web that will include a lot of my primary sources and supplementary materials and things that got clipped, you know, from the final version. And I did something similar with my friend Julian Mayland when we wrote about Minitel, and we have a big online archive of Minitel related materials, including not just the terminals and the official stuff, but lapel pins, weird ephemera, pop songs, other things that mention Minitel, and that's at minitel.us. So if you're interested in these kind of topics, we're trying to get as much of that material available to the general public as possible.
And we'll put these links on the site too, on our site, plutopia.io, when we post this discussion. And obviously we could have gone on for another 5 or 6 hours. So I do hope that you'll return and talk to us some more in the near future.
I would love that. I had a blast.
Yeah.
I know, you guys, I'm like making notes. I'm like, can I find a copy of that Megadeth site?
Oh, that would be great. I'd like to see it again.
Right.
Hey, I only maybe barely saw it then.
Maybe on the Internet Archive.
Yeah. I was thinking, can I tell you one more? I know we're like almost out of time, but I had a very similar experience during the year of the first Lollapalooza where they were saying, oh, we have a tour diary on the web and you can go check it out. And it was like, it's very DIY. And then the next year they had a firm do it and they did it in Shockwave. And I think we can see the earlier one and not the more recent one because of the problems of preservation around Shockwave and Flash. And it's just super interesting to see these, like the kind of Swiss cheese of that, those early years of what makes it through and what is kind of lost time.
I do have one more question. Have you ever seen the Dead Media website?
Yeah, I have.
Yes. Yeah, Tom Jennings built that for Bruce Sterling when Bruce was doing the Dead Media project. And there's a lot of this stuff on there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you open your scope up to 100 years or more, you start to see that we are building and rebuilding things with some kind of like, I don't know, common drive, common motivation over time.
We're building a network of rabbit holes to go down.
Interconnected rabbit holes.
But now it's time to go off to the Discord site. I wanted to talk about Discord, but we don't really have time. We'll talk about that next time.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. That was fun.
Well, thank you all very much. Looking forward to talking soon.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.